do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Mm-hmm. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. Today, after a brief hiatus, we are thrilled to be returning for season 6 of the podcast, where we will continue to bring you the stories and insights of some of the most purpose-driven leaders on the planet. And today's episode is no different. I'm over the moon to be interviewing today the incredible Jessica Hickman. Jess is the founder and director of Bullyology and an advocate for the Upstander movement. She's a global speaker, she has a TED Talk, and is deeply passionate about equipping schools, workplaces, and community groups with the tools and strategies to create thriving, respectful environments that are free of bullying, harassment, and violence. The Upstander movement is all about empowering individuals to speak out and take action against injustice and harm in their communities. Recently, Jess did a TED Talk, which you can find online, called Why Bystanding Poses the Greatest Threat to Our World. And I can definitely say that it is worth checking out. Jessica is also the acclaimed author of The Bullyologist, Breaking the Silence on Bullying and The Upstander Leader, How to Develop a Speak-Up Culture, which has received prestigious awards, including the RDA Australian Career Book Awards in 2023, the UK 2023 Business Book Awards, and the Australian Business Book Awards for HR and Management. Today, we'll dive into Jess's personal journey, the challenges she's faced, and how she's turning bystanders into upstanders. We'll explore the neuroscience behind bystanding, practical strategies for creating a culture of speaking up, and Jessica's vision for the Upstander movement. We'll also touch on her latest project and keynote, which really covers off bystanding in business with a focus on the emergence of the upstander economy. And so without further delay, grab yourself a cup of tea, your favorite beverage, and strap yourself in because this conversation is a good one with the one and only Jess Hickman. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. Jess Hickman, it is such an honor to have you beaming into the studio live with me this afternoon. You're somebody that I've worked quite closely with over the last 12 months, and I'm just beyond excited to share your message, everything you stand for, with the world today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back. And I feel like this conversation has been a long time coming.
I absolutely agree with that. And in my view, there is no time like the present than to dive right into what I believe is such a crucial message and such a significant message at this point of time in human history. Before we go on a journey through all of your content, and there's so much to explore, I want to start with a question that I've been asking all of my guests, and it is simply this: what question are you asking yourself that is currently guiding your life or your work forwards at this point in time?
Oh, that's a great question. And I guess everything I do in work, life, and business is towards the cause and pondering the question, how can we end unnecessary human suffering, whether that's in workplace, school groups, community, and as a global society, constantly pondering this big question.
It is a big question. And I guess we're going to attempt to answer some of that question across the course of today's conversation. I'd love to zone in on a quote that I know you hold really close to your heart. The quote is this: when the whole world is silent, even one voice becomes powerful. These words were spoken by Malala Yousafzai, who became an international symbol for girls' education after being shot by the Taliban in 2012. Jess, I'm wondering, can you tell me why these words have shaped your purpose in the world today?
Yeah, I think it's really powerful and it resonates a lot with my work. Considerably thinking about why people stay silent and the power of that one voice that can shape an outcome from a situation. And in Malala's case, an activist for education and women's rights and girls' rights, but also in my work, I hope that I can be a beacon of light. I know that it isn't often easy to be that voice of change because often you are speaking up against the status quo as such, whether it's in the form of flagging unethical behavior or unsafe behavior. And I think that it was one person who spoke up and let me know what was happening to me in my situation wasn't okay. That person really was the catalyst for everything I do today. And that was signposting me to mental health support when I was suffering extensive bullying. So when the whole world is silent, even one voice can be powerful. One upstander can change the outcome and ultimately end a catalyst of suffering through that courageous action of speaking up.
Jess, you just made reference to your personal story, and I'd love to hear a little more about that. I'm wondering if you can take me back to June 2017 when you found yourself far from home here in Australia. You're originally from Wales, and you were lying in a hospital bed. You were physically, emotionally, psychologically burnt out and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder from workplace harm. I'm wondering if you can share with me in a little more detail that chapter in your life.
Yeah, and even listening to you repeat that back to me, Beck, it feels bizarre that this can happen in what I call a modern country such as Australia, where there's policy procedures and legislations to protect employees. But I learned the hard way that unless there are courageous people that challenge these behaviours, ultimately people suffer at work. So that pivotal moment in my life came because I had suffered extensive bullying and harassment for 3.5 years. So June 2017 was a hospital bed incident. But I just want to take you back a step further to 2013. I arrived in Australia from the UK, like many people, a young, ambitious backpacker with a dream of the land of opportunity. And I was very fortunate to be offered a role working in a human resource position on a large oil and gas project. This was a really exciting opportunity because it challenged me with regards to my career, but also was an opportunity for sponsorship and staying in the beautiful country of Australia. But that did not come without its challenges, as we've mentioned. And I fitted seamlessly into the workforce. Over 6 months, I identified some gaps, predominantly in construction, oil, gas and resources industry, around isolation, loneliness and mental health issues. And ultimately, that was my first insight into suicide in the construction and resources industry. So I decided to use my previous experience of working in local government and council, running youth and homeless drop-in centres, to create a nurturing workplace culture and environment. And ultimately, I realised that no matter what our job title is or experience or cultural background, all of us want to feel seen, heard and valued. And there really wasn't a culture where people felt that, I call it love or connection or respect. And people felt like they were just a number. So I realized in the first 6 months that I needed to build a culture of trust. And I did that by walking around, building rapport, learning people's names, cultural background, family heritage, kids' names. And over time, people started to trust me and respect me and ask for help. I'm not a psychologist, but what I did know as a leader was where to signpost people to help. Things were going great. We started to see a cultural shift, and cultural shift happens over time and consistency and leaders showing up. But the reason I tell you this story isn't to gloat about my success, even though I'm extremely proud. 6 months into my role, I personally myself had a new leader, and that person was head of the HR department, human resources, so ultimately in charge of the people and humans within the business. And that person was a serious perpetrator of injustice, someone who bullied and harassed others. And I unfortunately became the preferred choice because I now know the reason was I'm highly competent, empathetic, kind, and had rapport. So as a high achiever, this person bullied me relentlessly. The more successful I became, the more the bullying and the harassment ramped up. And that could be winning awards, nominated as Northern Territory and Achiever of the Year for my work, Exceptional Women in Resources, to having the client ask me to come and sit on the board of directors to share my expertise or findings. And ultimately, the repeated pattern of behaviors was the more successful I became, the more the bullying and harassment happened. And at first it was subtle threats around my visa, subtle comments in manager's meeting that was packaged as banter to belittling me based on my cultural background or accent, to then gender-based slurs, extreme sexism, to accusing me of having interpersonal relationships with every man or male I spoke to, to not understanding how a female can be successful in what he perceived was a man's world in the workplace. So there was many factors that kept me in this employment. It was the fact that I loved the work that I was doing and felt purpose, that I was contributing good, that I was helping people, which is the core of everything I do. But ultimately, also, I was on a visa and little Miss Stubborn thought, you will not push me out of a workplace for doing a good job, let alone a country. So I stayed, but I didn't actually understand at the time the physical, psychological and emotional harm that can happen to an individual that is working and living in a high, intense risk environment, such as a workplace that is toxic. And by toxic, I mean poisonous, that impacts the holistic, spiritual, physical, mental, and emotional aspects of a being. And that June 2017 was the catalyst of extreme collapse and physical burnout from a long string of psychological harm, but also emotional. And June 2017 is when my physical body collapsed from heightened nervous system and burnout, and really was the catalyst of change.
Jess says there's 3 points in there that I find really interesting. Firstly, it is unimaginable to consider that this is still happening in the modern workplace. And yet these types of stories are playing out all over Australia, probably all over the world as we speak.
Yeah.
But to zone in on Australia, the other thing that I think is showcased in your story is the prominence of tall poppy syndrome. I'm curious to know, as you've shared this story with others on speaking stages or podcasts like this, what kind of feedback have you got, and what have been your insights into tall poppy syndrome in our country?
Well, absolutely. And if I speak to Australia alone, tall poppy syndrome is a big cultural observation of what I've witnessed. And for anyone listening that hasn't heard of tall poppy syndrome, it's imagine a field of poppies. And when one grows above the other, there's this culture of chopping others down. And I think this is important to mention, because when I go into a workplace or onto a stage, we can talk about what I call the spiky end of workplace culture, which is bullying, harassment, discrimination, but also tall poppy syndrome is this real, can often be subtle and invisible behavior that can tear cultures apart. And by that, I mean people don't reach their full potential in the workplace because their fear of ridicule or judgment from others or a culture of chopping down. But also people can fall into this trap of also being a perpetrator, where they humiliate others if they speak up, or bully them or ridicule them if they actually raise awareness to a topic or issue or share a good idea in a meeting. And my observation in Australia is it's really prominent across organizations, industries, and even schools, where there is a culture of chopping others down. And when I learned about tall poppy syndrome, it was actually quite freeing for me, I'll be honest. Mm. And I realized there was nothing I could have done other than continue to be a good person. And I was actually bullied, not because, I don't know, I look different or because I was poor performer. I was actually bullied because I was a high achiever and a kind person. And I think that's important in the context of looking at workplace culture, because often I see the high performers bullied or humiliated, or the high achievers. And even we look at social media, whereas someone may do good in the community or lead in purpose-led work, and there will always be someone in the comments section that wants to drag them down, pull them down for their success. And it is an issue globally, but predominantly in my work in Australia, very prominent.
Mm. The third point I wanted to zone in on in relation to your story is that I think it would be understandable if you had literally, you know, curled yourself up in a ball, got into bed, then got up the next morning, decided to pack your bags and just run away from that situation. But instead, you turn that pain into purpose. And today, your mission is to cultivate a generation of upstanders, one person, one voice, one action at a time. And so I just want to acknowledge the courage it takes to step into that kind of transformation and take such a difficult situation and alchemize that into something that enabled your own healing, but also that has allowed you to step into service and to help so many other people. Now, in order to truly understand your mission to cultivate a generation of upstanders, we first need to understand its opposite. And the opposite that I'm talking about today is bystanding. And so with that in mind, I'd love you to take a moment to clarify for our audience what bystanding means to you, to define it. And I'd also love you to dive into some of the research around the bystander effect to help people to be able to connect the dots on why bystanding poses the greatest threat to our workplaces and our world.
Yeah, thanks, Beck. And look, what's important about this story is that I reported the bullying 32 times. 32 times the people that, if they chose to, had the power and influence to stop the behavior immediately. So on reflection, that pivotal moment in the hospital bed where I decided to use the experience to be a catalyst for ending harm, I realized through my research and work that yes, we will have perpetrators of injustice that prey, target, bully, harass, and discriminate on others. But in Australia as a whole, I realised that we had, and globally, we have a real issue with people falling into the bystander zone. And ultimately, that is people that witness something that they feel is wrong, or, you know, feel in our body, the common in a meeting that, you know, raises our nervous system and we think, oh, that was a bit uncomfortable. Or they witness an act of violence or hear of domestic violence or behaviours in the workplace. And the easy option as human beings is to diffuse responsibility, to look the other way. And it made me think about how and why do we opt to look the other way? And I realised there was a body of research which coins the popular term called the bystander effect. And the bystander effect ultimately says through research that as human beings, when situations become uncomfortable and difficult, our natural instinct and desire is to diffuse responsibility, to assume someone else will deal with it, to use language such as, well, that's a bit above my pay grade, or I'm not going to get involved in that. The easy option is to be avoidant. And I realize this is actually destroying workplace culture. It's destroying community groups and family groups and school communities. And I realize the bystander effect is really prominent in all aspects of society. And the bystander effect was coined by social psychologists Bibb Lanteen and John Darley following the 1962 murder of a lady called Kitty Genovese. And I think this is important and always resonates with a lot of people. Kitty was a young lady that was actually brutally attacked and murdered in New York City. Upon investigation, the police found that there were many witnesses that had seen, heard an incident, whether that was closing the blinds, turning up the radio, or walking the other way. And it was found that actually there was 38 witnesses. No one called the police. So this sparked the massive research into understanding as humans, how and why do we diffuse responsibility? And ultimately, the bystander effect, it found that there's actually two components to this. The diffusing responsibility aspect, where the easy option is to diffuse responsibility, but also the second part of it is what I call a monkey see, monkey do mentality, where we look around and observe our environment. If other people are ignoring the comment or pretending they didn't hear it or laughing at the situation, we tend to copy because we are, you know, social animals as humans. So diffuse responsibility and then that monkey see, monkey do mentality. So it made me reflect on my workplace experience where I would be sat around a board table of my colleagues, predominantly males, and a comment would be made based on my gender or my appearance. And people tended to do the same thing in that scenario. And that was to look at the highest paid person in the room, the HIPAA effect, highest paid person's opinion. And, you know, if the CEO would laugh at the joke, so would everyone else. If the project manager would pretend they didn't hear it, that would be the cultural subset or tone. So I realized we actually get enrolled into cultures and the bystander effect infests our success in the workplace. And I realized in my work that, yes, I can raise awareness on bullying, harassment, discrimination, and all the behaviors that impact us. But what's important to me is helping people understand their evolutionary traps and where they actually fall into the bystander effect and how they can challenge themselves to step forward, to choose to be an upstander rather than a bystander. And that comes with the conscious awareness, but also sometimes challenging our own unconscious bias as well.
So I'd love to dive a little more deeply into the evolutionary hangover that you just referenced. You recently did a TED Talk at the end of last year, I think in Swansea, if I recall correctly. And in watching that TED Talk, you spoke about the neuroscience behind bystanding. And I'd love to unpack that a little bit further. The reason being that I think it's very easy to go, oh, well, the solution is simple. Stop bystanding and start upstanding and then the world will be a much better place. But based on my understanding, there are aspects of bystanding that are innate to our nature and the neuroscience helps us to understand why. So I'd love to invite you to share a little bit more about how that plays out for us.
Yeah, great. So the neuroscience says that we have two systems in the face of adversity. One of them is distress and one of them is sympathy. But when something happens that causes distress, our natural instinct is to move towards that fight or freeze behavior. So actually it can make us actually really challenging to actually override that mechanism. And it's easy for our systems to shut down. And I think this is important when recognizing some of the reasons why people don't speak up against violence or don't intervene if they see a fight on the street or even an assault in the workplace. And that can be a sexual assault. People go into the distress function, which ultimately is the freeze response often. And I think it's important because that is our evolutionary hangover, as you call it, whereas we actually need to override a mechanism that is through our biology and our systems that actually can cause us to just disengage. And I think it's important to understand the neuroscience because it is easy for me to tell people it's important to speak up. But I need people to understand the neuroscience behind the reasons why we do freeze, because what happens if we freeze and don't speak up? It actually comes with a lot of guilt and shame as well. So I think it's important to recognize that because, one, when we recognize something or we pay attention to it, we can actually catch ourselves as human and make the conscious decision to act rather than freeze or shy away or become avoidant. And that sometimes that act comes after the incident, because we can be in a state of shock or what I call paralysis. There were many times that I was completely so fearful that I would hide away in the office bathroom because my body was shutting down. And there was other times where I was fired up that I wanted to fight for what was right and the social justice. So again, with trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder and the impacts and outcomes of these behaviors, it can cause an array of human behaviors that is important to understand in the first step to educate people on how to be an upstander, how to move forward.
So just, we've obviously explored your personal story, which really puts the spotlight on workplace bullying. But your TED Talk really explores why bystanding poses the greatest threat to our world. And some of the themes that you've explored in your talk include, gender equality, women's rights. There are a lot of ways this is playing out at a macro level, not just in workplaces. And one example that you shared that is a story that I think sent the world into shock is the story of Harvey Weinstein. Many have heard about this story on the news, but I'd love to revisit it because I think it not only illustrates the nature of bystanding, but it also provides a powerful entry point into the importance of upstanding. So I'm wondering if you can walk us through that story.
Yeah, great. So, well, not great, but the Harvey Weinstein story was really a catalyst for the work I do now also. The Me Too movement broke in 2017, and really that happened because Harvey Weinstein, who was a once powerful Hollywood figure and producer, someone was courageous enough to speak up and share their truth on serious sexual harassment to the point of sexual assault and, you know, also rape. And that was found, that one person was the catalyst for a global movement of courageous people saying Me Too. And that one voice was the power to create a movement of change. And it amplified people all around the world's voice and really was the catalyst for the first time of people being able to share their truth, and a big highlight globally coming onto the sexual harassment and sexual violence movement. And more recently in Australia, legislation has been passed called Respect at Work. And it's really interesting that when I started to do my business in 2017, I was knocking on many doors, talking about bullying, sexual harassment, and having many doors closed in my face. Whereas even though it's horrific that this violence and harassment has to happen, movements like the Me Too movement have been a catalyst for people to find their voice and be able to share their truth. And it's just unfortunate that it takes, you know, an act of violence and then someone having to speak up, which we can know in many cases, and more recently in Australia, the Brittany Higgins case, of how a courageous person, whether you call them a whistleblower or an upstander, can have extreme backlash publicly for speaking their truth. And it is really challenging. And I am just grateful for these courageous people that do speak up and share their truth. And I hope that I try to be a beacon of light as an upstander myself, but it isn't easy because there are going to be people that like to operate cultures, organizations, community groups with a culture of silence. And they are often the people that cause the harm to the people that speak up and share their truth.
Jess, while we're on this subject, I know you also recently spoke at an event in Orange as a part of the national rally to end domestic violence in Australia, another pervasive issue. I'd love to invite you to comment on why this issue has fired you up the most. And of course, it's, I think for any woman, it's an issue that's going to fire you up. What I'd love to know is how can we, as upstanders, advocate for the solution to what is such an enormous problem in our country?
Oh, this whole topic, I could do a whole podcast on it. Yeah. But yeah, I think I've really fired up because anyone that is suffering unnecessarily, what fires me up. And the case with domestic and family violence is it has always been there. And unfortunately, it will probably always happen behind closed doors. But particularly in Australia, there are a lot of women. And at the time of speaking at the rally, which was a few weeks ago, there had been 35 women killed by their intimate partner. And what infuriates me and many around this was that many of these people, men, this is men's violence we're speaking about specifically, had been flagged to the police. The system had failed to protect the women, or ultimately, they had been left to suffer or ultimately die. And these are only the people that is reported statistically. And I think that I first became, while my personal story isn't around domestic and family violence in the workplace, often I can be delivering a talk or be at an event and I can talk about bystander versus upstanding. And there's never usually an event where someone doesn't disclose family violence or recognize that they are at the hands of a perpetrator. And that can also be family violence as in a father, even a mother that had inflicted pain and harm. And I think it's important because even when I speak about workplace bullying or behaviours in the workplace, I used to phrase and say that if someone is suffering domestic and family violence, as humans, we tend to know what to do. We understand that we need to call the police. We refer them to support services. But ultimately, we know that the wounds and scars are invisible and it can often take a lifetime to heal, and even generational trauma. I found more recently that often people don't know what to do if someone discloses family and domestic violence. And I used to make that reference because I would also compare it to workplace violence. And I still make this comparison. But often in the workplace, people can disclose that they are suffering bullying, harassment, discrimination, whatever form of violence it may be. And people can say, oh, toughen up, princess, it's the industry, as I was told. Or just move your chair away from him, her, them. Or move departments or change job. But often what we fail to recognize with workplace harm and violence is the fact that the scars are also invisible and can take a lifetime to heal. So I reckon as a culture, we've got a lot of work to do to understand how to support victims of violence and harm, whether it's the workplace, home, or whatever context it may be in. But ultimately, as a society, we've got a long way to do to go with prevention. Because we are very good at saying we've got an issue when we're reactive and the damage is already done, which we're seeing in society now. But what about the prevention? And I do a lot of work in schools back. And a project I'm working on at the moment is called UpGen, where I've partnered with a lady called Brooke Watts, who works in the agriculture industry, to deliver school programs in regional areas. Because the observations we've had in schools is around sexism, horrendous language, which is gender-based against women, but also outdated biases around gender stereotypes in the workplace. Construction's a man's world, agriculture's a man's world, wolf whistling, hitting girls in private areas, that kind of stuff. So I think it's important to talk about the fact that you mentioned my whole mission and purpose is about inspiring or building a generation of upstanders. And I do know that it is going to take a lifetime of my work because these behaviours are instilled into a young age, and that can be because of technology, social media, access to pornography, unhealthy ideas around how a relationship looks because they're watching hardcore pornography at as young as 8. So, domestic and family violence, we've got to be proactive in stamping out this with future generations that could be perpetrators with behaviours they're showing now as children.
So, Jess, I'd love to dive into what we can do if we're wanting to shift along the spectrum from being a bystander to an upstander. What process or model can we deploy, and how can we use that model to better understand where we're at on that spectrum?
Absolutely. So what I realized is, and this is for anyone listening, my book is called The Upstander Leader. It is chapter 5 of my book. And when I would talk to people across the world, across the industries and workplaces, I started to hear some common language. And I realized there isn't a one size fits all for why people become a bystander. And what I found through my work was there's actually three bystander zones: the unconscious zone, the uncomfortable zone, the avoidance zone, and the fourth zone is what I call the upstander zone. And I realized that often people don't become an upstander or speak up because they are in what I call a state of sleepwalking. They're unconscious of how the relationship dynamics around them, or even how their words, actions, behaviors, and beliefs are impacting other people. And that could be choosing to focus on productivity or profit over people. And I found that sometimes people are unconscious and they only find out that there is damage or harm happening, let's say, in their workplace because of a safe work conversation or compensation claims are soaring or productivity drops and absenteeism creeps in. So that's zone number one. People move from unconscious. So step number one is to recognize and look around at your environment, the behaviors, the relationships, the conversations, and actually look at yourself. Is your language, behavior, or beliefs impacting people positively or negatively? And that could also be unconscious bias. And I do actually see a lot of leaders get themselves in heat or trouble because they make comments that are outdated or based on cultural beliefs or unconscious bias around gender. So the second zone of this model is where I find people often are landing in what I call the uncomfortable zone, where they have heightened awareness to what's happening. So reflecting on my experience, my colleagues knew the bullying was happening because they would see the gender bits or hear the gender bits slurred, even a folder being thrown at my face. And, you know, they would feel uncomfortable. Their nervous system were heightened. But often they didn't have the capability or tools or know where to get help, particularly if that perpetrator was the head of HR. So people can often sit in the uncomfortable zone where they know something is wrong or witness it, but they just don't know what to do. So they stay in a heightened state. The third zone is the avoidance zone. And unfortunately, in my work, I see a lot of leaders, workplace and organization leaders, but also country leaders sit in this zone. And they know of the human suffering, whether it's domestic and family violence, whether it's, you know, we have famine across the world, whether there's poverty, whether there's women and girls being held hostage in a country. And often they can know that this is happening, but they choose to be avoidant for political gain, for profit gain, or simply because they are too busy to deal with the issue. And this actually is the catalyst of why human suffering happens. And in my example, I reported my bullying 32 times and it went into the avoidance zone, the too hard basket, that someone else will deal with it basket. Ultimately, through my work, Beck, I want to raise awareness so people acknowledge and know what is happening in their environment, their country, their workplace, socially, but also build capability to know how to move from bystander to upstander, to help them build their toolkit. And in my book, I've got a 5-step methodology to help them build awareness, to fine-tune their listening skills, to develop a learning culture, but ultimately to unlearn those behaviours or beliefs. And ultimately, to encompass all of that is to create a loving environment where people feel seen, heard, and valued and respected.
I love your reference to the idea of unlearning, because it does feel like the art of unlearning is, it's not only significant in navigating a world of rapid change, which we all find ourselves in, but if we're genuinely wanting to ignite human progress and move the dial forward on these issues, there is so much that we need to unlearn with regards to cultural conditioning, the status quo, and all of these things that we considered to be normal that are actually fundamentally destructive and posing a great threat to our world.
Absolutely. And I do a lot of work in regional and remote Australia. And often these the people that I work with, maybe it's a local council where they are the major employer in a regional area. So these people have grown up together, drink at the pub together. There's often, you know, family members working together. So this could be their only job. Mm. And it's funny when I talk about unlearning, and often I can be the first point of contact from outside of the organization where they've had these conversations. And, you know, a prime example could be I was working with an organization not long ago, and there was some sexist remarks, and it was packaged as banter. And I said to this this gentleman, "That's really interesting how you think that's funny and banter." And the person was a female, and you said it was too sensitive and, you know, woke and fluffy, all of these comments. But also I heard you say that you've got a daughter that works in the organization and also your wife in different departments. How would you feel if that comment or banter was directed at them? In no word of a lie, he had a full physical response. His fists hit the table and he said, "Well," and I won't repeat what he said. But I said, "Well, that's so interesting." And I could, for the first time, see his shoulders drop. And it was like the same when the penny drops. Mm. And for the first time, he was challenged on his behavior, but also his unconscious bias. And that's an example of the work I do. It's not just these are the problems, this is the solution. I take people through a journey of a self-awareness journey of unlearning and picking those social conditionings from maybe growing up in a household where casual sexism and racism is the status quo, or whether that behavior is acceptable as at the local footy club or know, where people hang out. And just taking them on that journey to look at their holistic world and think about their impact and, to your language, their purpose, and whether they are part of the problem or solution. And I love it because you can see a transformation in even the hardest nuts. And one of my clients, who's the CEO of a council, once gave me the feedback that I have the art of enrolling the naysayers, the hardest crews, the concreters that think this work is fluffy and, you know, ridiculous, whereas enrolling them in the process so they feel like they're leading the change, and just seeing that purpose ignited in them where they feel like they have an impact in their workplace, world and community is one of the blessings in this work.
So Jess, I'd like to take a moment now to shift gear, really, and give our audience a little bit of a sneak peek into what is coming next in your world, because I think this is going to be huge. Now, I know that you're currently working on a talk addressing not only personal bystanding, but also bystanding in business. And this is a topic that really tackles some of the biggest challenges that we face in the world today. So I'm wondering if you can share with us a little bit of an overview of the trends that are catalyzing what you've referred to as the upstander economy.
Yeah, and this is very exciting because this is very fresh, and I am currently doing a body of research around this at the moment and developing my keynote. And one of the reasons why I decided to focus on this topic was from conversations with industry and even country leaders, where they started to share some of their observations. And a big piece of work I did for my last book, The Upstander Leader, was interviewing a selection of millennials and Gen Zs who are the future of work. And I was hearing time and time again that, yes, they wanted to work for an organization that had a thriving workplace culture where people felt seen, heard and valued. But ultimately, they wanted to work for an organization that valued ethical conduct, that valued cultural diversity, that valued the environment, that valued contribution on a global scale. And ultimately, they wanted to feel like they had purpose. But I realize actually for organizations to survive in the decade of change or the evolution of the next 10 years as these millennials move into leadership positions or grow their purpose and Gen Zs ultimately become significant, I realize that organizations need to understand how they may be falling into what I call a bystander matrix. And people is just one part of that. And if you're happy for me to do so, Beck, I'll talk you through my thoughts around that matrix.
I would love to hear all about this matrix because based on my understanding and doing my research for today's podcast, this matrix basically encapsulates how bystanding plays out in a very practical sense in a business context.
In a business context. So, yeah. So ultimately, I want business leaders to understand and actually reflect on whether they are part of the problem or solution and whether they're focusing on these four key aspects. So the first one is I often see people become an ethical bystander where they violate ethical standards or code of conducts, and that could be through behavior or policy. It can be around corruption, dishonesty, and a breach really of personal conduct. So ethical bystanding can get people in a lot of trouble because they can end up in a court of law because they've breached policy or been dishonest. And I know personally working for an organization that was completely unethical, that made me feel yucky. So as an employee, that wasn't a good experience for me. And I didn't have a great experience. So again, understanding the future of work is ethical conduct, honesty, and companies that are doing really well in this space have their like code of conduct. They walk the talk, and ultimately they take their employees on a journey to make them feel that value. So that's step number one with regards to the bystander matrix, so ethical bystanding. The second part of that matrix is what I call cultural bystanding, where there's a lot of, I see this day and day, discrimination in business, but also a contradiction of values. So I often see business have, these are the values of our business, but they don't actually practice what they preach. They have really unethical recruiting processes that don't value cultural diversity. That could be around cultural insensitivity, but also exclusion practices. They don't value, recently I was reviewing an organization and they really didn't value First Nations people and their respect of land. So again, people need, and organizations need to have that level of cultural respect where people feel that they are part of the organization and not discriminated against based on their cultural background. So that's a second component people really need to, or business leaders need to understand. The third part of the matrix is where I see people social bystanding, where the organization ignores social issues. You would be surprised around how many organizations and business leaders attend my conferences and talk where they haven't heard of the Me Too movement or Black Lives Matter movement or the March for Justice movement. And it's really interesting because statistically, these are impacting people in the workplace. Yet these people are in charge of large organizations and sometimes hundreds of thousands of people, and they do not have a finger on the pulse around social issues, and they've just become a bystander to that. And I've given you an example of how social bystanding can happen on a global scale. Recently in Australia, there was mass stabbing, as you're aware. And what was really interesting about this was how Twitter X decided to be a social bystander to withdrawing content, which is in the media. The Australian government has required Elon Musk and X to pull down that content, and they have chose to be a bystander and allow that to play out. So it's really interesting how organizations need to choose to be on the right side or the wrong side. And that's making sure that they have a finger on the pulse of what's impacting people's mental health around and physical and emotional health. And I think that I often reference the best leaders are socially aware to what's happening on a global scale, and that's recognizing how wars and famine, and we're in a time of war, that can be impacting people from different religious groups. Choosing to be a bystander to this is detrimental and can position people as a leader that does not care. So that's the fourth zone of the matrix. That's the third zone. And then the fourth zone, sorry, is environmental bystanding. So this is a key driver for success of business. And I think that previously, you know, there's, I call it nonsense, and this is a personal opinion around climate change is a myth and all of this, whereas now we can see the effects of environmental damage that we have done as humans. So talking to a lot of people, interviewing them for my book, they care about the environment. They want to work for an organization that values, you know, products or recycling or has a mission that cares for the planet. And I think that that disengage between people and planet has gone on too long. And I'm seeing a merger of the two where people know that we beat from the same pulse. So really leaders that choose to not value the environment will probably fall behind, lose staff, or not have people working for them that feel like they have purpose. So we've got the four zones, the bystander matrix, which is ethical, cultural, social, and environmental.
What a robust model and an incredible filter to view the health of your business through that lens, especially with regard to the upstander economy, which, you know, based on what you've just shared with us, we're seeing these trends being, you know, millennials, but also policy like environmental and social governance and other aspects that are driving forward this kind of new age in business. And now we have the bystander matrix as an overlay to really allow a business to get radically honest about what it is they're turning away from and not addressing that's actually playing out within their business. There are so many rabbit holes we could go down here, which people might have to wait for the keynote to explore, explore some of the themes and some of the case studies here. Outside of the bystander zones, which you shared before, which is, of course, a really great tool to help individuals in a business to shift from bystanding to upstanding, what other filter can a business use to be able to really look at their business objectively and understand the areas where they can really become upstanders?
Yeah, so I think on this, what I've developed are what I call the five P's of success in the upstander economy. And ultimately, what I'm seeing is organizations that really value ethical products, pricing, having places that are eco-friendly or sustainable, having promotions that represent the population, that could be how people look, different demographics or cultural background, or promotions that actually resonate with the population, and actually valuing people. So on those five P's, really, I go through the process with my keynote and workshop to help people focus on the product, the price, the place, the promotions and the people, and ultimately to recognize where they may be thriving or falling in one of those five areas. Because ultimately consumers of a business, or whether those whether it's employees or consumers, are ultimately looking for businesses that have that purpose, that care about the environment, that are socially in tune, and ultimately a lot of conversations around culture now and respect. So it is a big question I ask leaders. And often when I talk to leaders about this, they're like, oh, I've never actually thought about that element, or I've never thought about people in the regard of, I talk a lot about human slavery. And in that aspect, I say, yes, we can look at the people and focus on workplace culture. But when we think about people, are you actually in tune with your supply chain? Is it ethical? And often organizations I've worked with have found that there has been child labor, or in fast fashion, for an example, there's been unethical pay and work standards. With the rise of social media, business leaders and organizations can no longer be bystanders to this, because what is happening is everyone's a journalist, an investigator, where if you've got a smartphone and you're traveling, or you can visit a consumer site, or a factory, you actually can uncover a lot about a business. So I think the old school mentality of what people can't see, they can't harm us has changed. So it's important for business now, rather than to be reactive when they be found out, is to be proactive, to actually lean into what I call the upstander economy, get their ducks in order, because ultimately that keeps staff and retention, but also keeps customers, keeps out of the media, keeps out of a courtroom, and ultimately allows business leaders to keep their reputation that it can take a lifetime to build, but overnight it can disappear if you choose to be a bystander and ethical in your business practice.
And so, Jess, I imagine so much of this change is going to be driven forward by purpose-driven and pioneering leaders. So in your view, what qualities do you believe will be crucial for leaders as we move into the upstander economy?
Yeah, so I think definitely I call them the three E's, which is empathy, ethics, and equality. And I strongly believe that these will be the bedrock for the future society, where we want empathetic leaders that acknowledge people, understand their life experience, journey, suffering, but ultimately show up with empathy. Leaders that are ethical, and I think that encompasses everything we've discussed today, and value equality, whereas, yes, equal pay, but equal rights, and making sure that people feel seen, heard, and valued. And I guess the word that's been showing up a lot of time in workshops recently is humility, where people are looking for leaders that often can be humble, and organizations that have humility. And ultimately, that could be compassion, care, kindness. And a lot of work I've been doing at the moment is around the topic of love, which is really interesting because people can scrunch up when you think of love in a business concept or context. And I often say to people, love in the workplace isn't about the romantic interpersonal relationship you have with your wife, husband, partner, whoever. Ultimately, I've realized in my work, after interviewing thousands of people across industry, cultural background, and countries, at the core, what humans want from business leaders is that feel seen, heard, and valued. And they often say things such as, I want to be acknowledged. I want to have a pat on the back for doing good work or having a contribution. And ultimately, I want leaders to see me for who I am. And that's not feeling like I'm silenced or I'm a number on a shirt or a color shirt. Ultimately, I want people to recognize me. And at the core of that, I've realized it is love. And from the moment we're born into our parents and caregivers' arms, our number one desire as humans is to be loved. We start school, develop peer relationships, and again, at the core is that love component. And then often what I find is people enter the workplace, which can be ultra toxic or competitive. And at our core, no matter what our job title is or position in the world or workplace, our core desire is to be loved. Yet we forget about that in business. And often it can become ultra, I use the word masculine, but it's not, you know, men versus women. I found that I had to step into a masculine energy to feel like I needed to do more, be more, achieve more. But ultimately that causes burnout. And sometimes we forget just to take a pause and a breath and look around at our leaders and okay, how can we instill more love, compassion, care, and kindness, yes, into the workplace and our organizations, but ultimately with ourselves? How can we fill our cup before we fill others? And I think that's a big part of the work that I do now, is to recognize leaders and ultimately help them have that self-awareness and that self-love and compassion, so ultimately they can show up and be better leaders in the world or global society.
Wherever. Yeah. Jess, we could almost end the conversation on the love bomb. However, I am going to throw my last question your way, and it is simply this. If you had access to the world's biggest billboard or sign, and you could share like one word, one phrase, what would you say and why?
Gosh, I would say, one voice has the power to change the world. your voice has the power to change the world.
Well, I can certainly attest to the fact, and I'm sure all of our listeners would agree, that today your voice is changing the world, not only on this podcast, but on stages all over the world. It has been such an honour to have you share your story and your ideas, insights with us today. Where might our listeners discover more about who you are and the work you're doing in the world, and maybe even buy a book?
Yeah, great. So, look, you can find me by searching jesshickman.com. From there, you can find my books, my online course. My book is turned into a long-form course. So if you are listening today and would like to take the first step on recognizing where you're at on the bystander versus upstander zones and ultimately build your toolkit to become an upstander, you can do the online course. And if you are a leader of an organization listening today that would like to embed this training and keynotes and workshops into your workplace, please reach out by my website, jesshickman.com.
Awesome. And you can also check out Why Bystanding Poses the Greatest Threat to Our World on the TED website as well. It's an amazing speech and one that I think really provides a beautiful overview of some of the themes that we've spoken to today. Jess, it has been such a joy to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maklad, that is M-A-K-L-A-D, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.